We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on bluechipspeakersnava.org, desperately in need, will hear our speakers, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I can tell you one thing. I noticed our speaker didn't show up with his fiddle. It has become a tradition at the Atlanta Men's Workshop. He's one of two guys that serenade the group and at the last closing moments of the workshop, and always gives me chill bumps. I'm just getting chill bumps talking about it. Let's have Art come up.
Hey, everybody. My name is Art, and I'm an alcoholic. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. I once was at a meeting in which the speaker got to speak for 20 minutes, and I found that a real challenge because I like to talk. So I was very grateful to hear that you have an hour and a half meeting here. No? All right. I just brought a few notes to keep things on track here. Actually, those are some material I would love to have each and every one of you, if there are enough of them, to at least look at and read before you leave tonight concerning the Atlanta Men's Workshop for You Men and for the 60th Georgia State Prepaid Convention, which is coming up in just 1 month here. Well, what it was like and how I found God and what it's like now and how I got here. I hope I never forget what it was like. I never want to go back to the situation I was in on August 11, 1998. Alcohol had taken everything for me that made anything worthwhile in life. Alcohol and another thing called mental illness managed to do the job pretty well. My first drink of alcohol occurred when I was about 13, 12 years old, and it was what I call a wine spritzer, a combination of 7-Up and Manischewitz Concord grape. Delicious. And I should have known that I was an alcoholic because my reaction when I finished that little bit of wine spritzer was to ask for another one. Something happened inside of me with just that little bit of alcohol that allowed me to relax for the first time that I could remember. I came from a kind of high-tension family and a high-tension community. The community itself was very strict. I, for example, got pulled over by the police with the lights going when I was about 13 or 14 years old because I wasn't riding my bike with my hands on the handlebars. And the policeman thought that was dangerous. And he said, if I ever see you do that again, I'm going to tell your parents. And this was a town of only 20,000 people, so it was a good shot that he was going to be patrolling that street every day. My brother got expelled from junior high school for chewing gum. Just didn't do much in that town except obey the rules, walk on the sidewalks. But when I had that drink of wine, all that social pressure for perfection that this town kind of professed kind of went away. It just went away. And I'd wish I thought that I could get away with having more drinks. I mean, I did a little bit in high school, more alcohol, but it's just, I think we never had alcohol in the house except for one bottle of whiskey that my dad kept up on the very top shelf in the kitchen cupboard, which he pulled down whenever his army buddies came along. They had a drink. And I found out later the reason probably was that my father's father was an alcoholic. At least he had all the tendencies of beating his children and his wife, of chasing after women, and doing some other things that some of us do. And so it was never really an issue in our home of drinking. It was never mentioned. It was never offered. It was never around. Until I got a chance when I was a senior in college to go to Europe. And the place I went to was probably ideal. And I suggest this for anybody who's not yet had enough, that you go to Germany and you taste what real beer tastes like and get that out of your system. Because I went from a zero drinker into a full-blown alcoholic in a matter of months. I was having beer with lunch. I was having beer with dinner on the weekends. We had drinking games that we sat around the cafes and the guest houses. And it was really kind of amazing. I didn't know that my pattern of drinking had already gone full-blown. I didn't know that there was any other way of drinking. I got drunk every time I drank. I was so drunk one night when I was in this little German town that I literally, you know, had one of those narrow streets with the cobblestones and the old medieval, you know, half-timbered houses. I literally bounced from side to side going up this hill trying to get back to where I was sleeping that night. I got drunk all the time, and I thought that was normal. I had no idea that what I exhibited was abnormal drinking. It seemed to me about just the only way to do it. Why drink unless you're going to feel it? I was the product of, not the product of, I was the carrier of delusional thinking from early on. I don't think that alcoholism per se caused that. I think that was part of my makeup. I had a great imagination, and I would live in that for a while. It turned out later on in my life, I ended up in a mental institution three times for some of my delusional thinking. It was pretty serious. But what I can tell you is this. Alcohol helped me along the way very quickly with that. I did not face life well. If there was a problem, I wanted out. I didn't want to deal with it. I wanted to escape. I wanted to, as one of our circuit speakers says, I wanted to get out of the right here, right now. Any way I could. Sometimes that would involve just physically moving somewhere else. Sometimes it was just, most times it was just drinking. And as my drinking career started, I can tell you exactly when it really started. I was 21 years old. 21 years old before my first real drink happened. My father took me out on my birthday. 21 was the legal age in Michigan where I grew up. And he bought me my first beer. Well, that's probably, he didn't make me an alcoholic, but that certainly got me on my way because the next day I was leaving for this trip to Germany that I just mentioned. And along the way, my drinking got worse and worse. It really got a good next step in it when I got married at age 24. And I married a woman who from New York, and her family had a family history of having a cocktail before dinner. And I kind of liked that idea. Didn't bother me at all. I would pour, of course. I don't know if anybody else has ever done that, insisted on that. But as the man of the house, I would pour the drinks, and of course I poured myself more than I poured her. She had this odd drinking pattern of having one martini and stopping. I drank scotch, at least initially until I couldn't afford it. I drank scotch. I used to measure it when I started. You know, a shot of scotch, ice cubes. Then it would be a shot and a half, measured, and then you'd start just pouring and eyeballing it. And then, I think I need a second drink. Because at that time, my life was getting a little complicated. I was married. I went back to school to get a degree. Well, let me put it this way. My marriage was interesting. My wife wanted to be married to a lawyer. So she suggested I should go to law school. Well, I would never say no to that. So she put me through law school at the school she was teaching at. I got free tuition, and she was earning a salary, so it didn't cost me anything. But I got in over my head. I mean, I guess I wanted to be a lawyer. I'm not really sure. I liked being a lawyer now. I can tell you that. I've grown into it. But it's a lot of pressure. Being a lawyer is a lot of pressure, particularly when I started out, I was doing trial work, and I was working 14, 16-hour days, trying to balance that with a family, and then the kids started coming. We had two daughters, wonderful girls. Both are grown now. One just got married. But I managed to ruin all this. I managed to ruin it all. What happened to me was this. I did not know of the progressive nature of alcoholism. I didn't even know that I was an alcoholic. As far as I knew at that point in my life, no one in my family was an alcoholic. I couldn't imagine that people didn't have the same reaction I did. But one thing did baffle me, and that is I could see people having a drink or two and then walking away from half a glass of beer, say. And I didn't get that, because I was going to finish my beer and then finish theirs. And then I would try to sneak a few more. My typical pattern by the time I was 35 years old, two young children, a career going for myself, and my wife had her own career. I'd come home. First thing I'd do is I'd say hello politely, and then I'd head for the bar, and I'd pour myself a drink and offer my wife one too. That was followed by another drink, and if I could, I'd sneak a third one before dinner. I didn't know that what was happening to me was I had slipped into that morass, and there was no way out of it by the time I realized that I might want to not drink so much. I might want to try to control it a little bit. I noticed that I was starting to have hangovers in the morning, particularly, I don't think I have any former clients here. I'd go into court in the morning hungover, my mind trying to think, and certainly my emotions are always on the edge. And I would be, I was one of those guys, and people who know me today can't imagine this, but I was I went from calm to rage in a couple of seconds. I would be a fist pounder on the table, steam coming out of my ears, red in the face, screamer. That's what alcohol helped me do. I was totally out of control, and yet I didn't realize what was going on. And this denial thing was so strong, at least in my case, that I really kind of walked up to the edge of the gates of insanity and death, not really understanding that drinking was a symptom of my problem. I thought if I could just figure out how other people drink successfully. And yet, 27 years of trying to figure that out, and I couldn't. You would think that something may have dawned on me at some point, but it didn't. Well, I had no time for my kids. I don't know about you, if you were a drinker and you had a family. They wanted my two daughters like to play ball, catch in the backyard. I'll be out there in a little while, as I was sipping on my beer on the weekend. New Year's Day was eventful because that was my day for watching college football all day and drinking beer. I wasn't being with the family, doing anything productive. And so both of my daughters grew up really without a father. A father, I was absent. I was just emotionally absent. I was mentally absent. I often was physically absent because I wanted to go out and do what I wanted to do. If there was an opportunity to have a drink, I'd do it. Playing golf was great. I go out with guys, and I was in a Wednesday night golf league for a couple of years, and after the ninth hole, we'd go into the clubhouse and buy pitchers, and I was just happy. I get home by 11 o'clock, drunk, as always, and wonder why my kids never brought their friends home. I was touchy. I was erratic. I can only say this now, in retrospect, that I could see it. And after doing some nine-step work with my children and my ex-wife, they let me know. Then at age 40, it came to a head. I had a nervous breakdown at age 40. I ended up in the hospital. They diagnosed me with bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and a few other things. And, you know, even though they kept me there for a month and a half, no drinking, no external stuff that I was always going to blame, if you had my marriage, you drink too, kind of thing. Even after that separation from alcohol and outside influences, I was still nuts. I was absolutely nuts. I attempted suicide. That's usually what got me into the psych ward. I did that three times. Alcohol did not help that. I was once able to stop drinking for 6 months because my doctor told me that I couldn't drink on the medication I was taking. And if there's a clear evidence of what it means to be an alcoholic, it's, I don't know what it is except this. I was okay for the first couple of weeks of not drinking. And then the thoughts started, the committee started. And I would start thinking about alcohol, drinking or not drinking, either one. I was thinking about alcohol. And that was okay, maybe it was tolerable for the next couple of weeks. So I'm up to about a month now. And I would just soldier through it. 2 months went by, it got worse. 3 months got by, it got worse. 4 months. I was just screaming in my head. That's all I thought about was not drinking. Don't drink, don't drink. You can't drink on this medication. By the time 6 months rolled around, I couldn't deal with it anymore. I had no solution. And so I said, well, I haven't had a drink for 6 months. I'm entitled to one. And we know where that ended up. After my second hospitalization, I came back and back to the house, and my wife was still putting up with me. I don't know why. She's a wonderful lady, but I certainly ruined her life too. And we started out with marriage counseling, which I encourage. If you're having trouble at home, please do this. It didn't work for me, but it helped me. My wife started this tradition of giving me performance appraisals. If you had my marriage, you'd drink too. These were typed, of course. She was a college professor. And she treated me like a candidate for a professorship at her university where she was required to do a kind of appraisal on people. Well, she gave me one. She had it hand-typed on her computer, and she would always leave it to me for me in an envelope on a chair in the living room New Year's Day. And I always would forget that I was going to get one of these. So I would always be surprised. Oh, it was the envelope again. And so this went on for 5 years. Every New Year's Day, I got the performance appraisal, and it wasn't satisfactory. So I would try harder. I would try harder in marital therapy and try to do what I could. But I was an alcoholic, and I was drinking. I mean, it was doomed. What happened on that fifth year? It was 1996. As I got the performance appraisal, 5 pages, single-space typed, at the end of which she says, and I think that we should separate. You can't do that to an alcoholic because my ego would not allow such an affront. I said, she came down that morning and said, did you read the letter? I said, yeah, I just want to think about it during the day. So I drank and watched football, as I always did. And then when the kids got put to bed at the end of the month, at the end of the night, she said, well, and I said, yeah, I read your letter and I thought about it all day, but I don't think we should separate. I think we should get divorced. Don't worry, I'll handle it. I'm the lawyer. One of the things I remember to this day about that, thinking about whether we should separate, not separate, divorce, not divorce, was this. If I get divorced, I won't have anybody watching over my shoulder anymore, watching how much I drank. Because it took a lot of energy to sneak the amount of alcohol, pour back from the handle jugs back into the regular bottle, to try to pretend like I wasn't drinking as much as I was drinking. And I had done that for years. So I decided that one of the pluses of getting divorced was I wouldn't have somebody watch over my shoulder anymore. So I got that taken care of, and I got divorced, and about 8 months later, I was back trying to commit suicide and drinking more than ever. I got through that one. But there was one thing that I do remember that just... I was living separately in a two-bedroom apartment, and I had a room set up for the kids who never slept over. They didn't want to be around me. They wouldn't tell me that. But I was supposed to pick up my younger daughter, who'd been on a sort of like a field trip, a youth group weekend out of town. And the buses came back in, and I was supposed to pick her up, I think, at 2:30, and I had started drinking about noon, and I did what I had been doing regularly, but by that time, I blacked out. And I was awakened by the phone ringing. And I picked up the phone, and I said, yes? And she said, Daddy, where are you? Everyone else has been picked up, and they're all gone. And I felt about that tall. Because I didn't know, when I started drinking that day, what was going to happen. I just didn't know. I didn't know I was going to black out. And I certainly didn't know that I was going to emotionally scar my daughter, who in front of all her friends and her teachers at her school, for which this was the field trip, she was the last one picked up, and I was half hour late doing that at best. That still hits me hard, realizing I was an unfit father. And I had done a lot of other things. As I mentioned before, not playing with him, not being involved with him, because I wanted to drink. Ultimately, I got fired from my job, and I'll tell you how that happened. I had a really good job. I'd had it for a couple of years. It was an assistant general counsel for an international food service company. And there was this lady, that's the kind word for her. She was also a lawyer, but she was on the corporate side, and I was on the franchise side. And she would come down and just, like a tornado, tear things up. And I went with a friend of mine, another lawyer, down to the human resources department. And to show you how delusional I was, I made the statement to the head of human resources, keep this lady out of my department. I didn't run the thing. Okay, I did not run this department. I was one of the attorneys. Keep this lady out of my department. What do I have to do, go postal here? I thought that was funny. I thought that was a big joke. Well, that was Friday afternoon, and Monday morning I was fired. Rightly so. But of course I hold a grudge. How dare they? I was only trying to improve things. So what? One of the reasons. They had 13 reasons that they had let me go. And the only one I can remember was that someone reported they had smelled alcohol in my breath one morning. Well, I had to drink at that point in the morning because my hand shook too much. I had to have something to, actually, I had to have two drinks in the morning just so I could write a legible signature. My nervous system had become so dependent on alcohol by that time that not drinking was not an option anymore. So I got fired from that job, and I said, I'll show them. Because remember, that the only thing I remember about why I got fired was someone smelled alcohol in my breath. I'll show them I won't drink. And I lasted a whole 6 hours. And that was pretty good. And about a week later of continually trying to stop drinking, I went into the kitchen. And I told myself, listen, I'll only have two drinks tonight. This is what I've been telling myself for years. I'll only have two drinks tonight. But then I added this to it. And if I can't do that, I'll call AA. You see, I had heard about AA. I had no idea what it was. I had heard about AA. And matter of fact, my internist, who read my lab results, could see clearly that I was an alcoholic. I mean, I had my internal organs shutting down pretty well at that time. And a strange thing happened. What happened that night? It's August 10th when I started, 1998. Was the same thing that happened every night before that. Every night. I'd have a drink, I'd have a second drink, I would black out, and somehow at 2 in the morning I'd come out of my blackout with an empty bottle next to me, with the TV still on, you know, one of those. Except this night was different, and I attribute it to the grace of God. I do believe that this night I had a moment of clarity. Because when I came out of the blackout and I saw the bottle empty, next to me empty, I realized for the first time that I had, of my own will and against my will, finished that entire fifth. I think I was down to pop off vodka or 5 o'clock gin or something like that at that point, whatever I could afford. And I had cut back from a larger quantity back to a fifth a night of hard liquor. I looked at that bottle and I realized a couple things. I was living alone. I didn't even have a dog or a cat to blame it on. No one was in my house. The door was locked. The shades were closed. I didn't answer the phone anymore because I didn't want people to hear me slur my words. They might think I'm an alcoholic. I didn't open the mail anymore because there might be bills in there I was afraid of paying, even though I had the money to pay them. I was afraid. The realization that I had drunk that entire bottle, that was the first time it really sunk down deep inside of me, and that no matter how hard I wanted to, I could not stop drinking. I believed at that point that I took the first step. When I realized that I was powerless over this thing called alcohol, I just collapsed on my knees in the middle of the living room and staring at a blank wall, just wondering, what am I going to do? And then a second thing happened, which I also think is God working in my life. I saw a vision. There was this big blank wall. I wasn't much of a decorator, so I didn't have the nice pictures and everything else. I was one of those bachelor types. And what I saw was this. I saw an older man dumpster diving with a large cardboard refrigerator box next to the dumpster. I knew that's where he lived, and I knew that's where he was getting his food that night. Something inside of me told me that that person was me, and it was just a matter of time. And I don't know why that connection happened then, but it did. And I just started crying. You know, I had great aspirations as a young man. great ones. I thought I'd be a perfect father and a perfect husband. I thought I'd be a great lawyer. I really thought I was a nice guy who just drank too much toward the end. But none of that was true. And the second amazing thing happened is I decided at that moment that I would call AA in the morning on my own for the very first time. See, all those times my doctor had suggested I call AA and go to the meeting, he'd follow up the next time I saw him, and he said, "Well, how'd you like the AA meeting?" I said, I didn't like it very much. I don't think it's really for me." I had never gone to an AA meeting. I just wanted to get my doctor off my back. So I was willing to tell any lie to do that. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, I waited a suitable amount of time to make sure everybody was in their office. I called AA, and the lady on the other end of the line had the nerve, after I said, I asked her, "Is there an AA meeting near me where I can go for a meeting?" And she accused me by saying, "Well, are you an alcoholic?" And I thought that was a big affront. I had no idea what she was trying to do is find out if I should go to a closed meeting or an open meeting. I took it as though she was accusing me of being an alcoholic. But for the first time in my life, to anybody, I said yes. She said, "Well, okay, well, there's a meeting not too far from you. It meets at 8:30. I suggest you be there at 8:15. Ask to speak to the chairman of the group." She told me where it was. I could walk there if I wanted. And I did that. And for some unexplained reason, I did not have a drink of alcohol that entire day. You figure that one out. I couldn't even stay sober 5 minutes at a time without a drink. And yet I stayed sober all day. Until 8, and I was just shaking, of course. And I got to this meeting, and I found a guy by the name of Pete, who became my first sponsor, and he said something in my very first meeting. I don't remember much about that meeting. I remember the room. I remember two things. First thing is that Pete said to me, "Art, you never have to drink again. Just do what we do." Looking back on it many years later, I realized the profound statement he made to me. He didn't say, "Do what we tell you." He didn't say, "Do what's in the book." He didn't say, "Do what you think." He said, "Do what we do." It's action that makes the difference. We can have all the knowledge of the book we want, but unless we're willing to take the action, it's of no avail whatsoever in my experience in the program. So I did exactly what he told me to do. And how I found God. I thought I was very religious. I thought I was appropriately Jewish. That I went to synagogue every weekend, every Friday and every Saturday morning. I even led the services sometimes. I led the daily minyan during the week sometimes. I was on the board of trustees of my synagogue. I was the president of the PTO of the religious school. I thought I was pretty religious, and I thought I knew what God was about. But Pete, being wise as he was, did a couple of things. First of all, he said, "Whatever you think you know about God, just set it aside. Just set it aside. We're going to try an experiment here. I want you to go through these 12 steps that we have in our book. I want you to take these steps one at a time, at your speed, and we'll see what happens. And then when it happens, we'll come back and we'll compare what you think about God as to what you had been taught growing up and experienced growing up." And that's what we did. And I went through the steps in about 6 months. I dawdled for a while because I was terrified of the fourth step. I was still a ball of fear. I was still dishonest. I still had all the character defects for quite a while in the program. The first thing that happened to me was I got willing, because I went to that meeting and I crossed the threshold of the room. I said there are two things I remember about that meeting. One was Pete telling me that I never had to drink again. The second thing that happened to me in that meeting was there was an energy in the room. People were happy. People were laughing. I hadn't been happy and laughing for decades. To me, life was pretty serious. There was an energy. I was like a depleted battery. I had nothing left inside. No energy, no nothing. And I knew that what they had, I needed. That was my first meeting. I knew that what they had, I had to have too. So I sincerely think I took the second step at my first meeting. I wanted what they had. I came to believe that whatever they had, I needed. I didn't know it would restore me to sanity because, frankly, when you've been certified insane three times in your life by qualified psychiatrists, you never know. But and maybe I'm a little insane today, but I certainly enjoy life a lot better than I did. So at the end of my first meeting, we went out for coffee, and Pete settled me down. You know, have you ever been at a meeting and you see a newcomer and they only put a little bit of coffee in their cup because they're shaking so much they can't hold anymore? Well, I was that shaken guy, and I put the cup on the table and I kind of got my face down into the cup, my nose into the cup, and tipped it a little bit so I could get the coffee out. And that didn't go away for quite a while. I still had the yips later on, about 6 months later. Just out of the blue, I jerked my arm just because my nervous system still hadn't recovered. But I progressed from two handing a cup to one handing a cup to actually being able to use a cup with a little, what do you call it? No, a sippy cup. Yeah, that would be appropriate. A cup with a handle on it that I could manage with just two fingers. Sippy cup. Thank you. I learned a couple of things. I learned to trust. I learned to trust Pete. And I think if you don't trust, you're not going to get this deal. You got to learn to trust one person. And it can take a while to learn to trust them because they have to become trustworthy. They have to show you that they are trustworthy. Pete showed me right from the get-go. He said, if he said he was going to do something, he always did it. He showed up when he said he was going to show up. He said, that's just what we do in AA. It's called character building. We suit up and we show up, doing what we need to do. The second thing is honesty, and I got to tell you the story before I wrap up and get going here. Pete, I was a pathological liar. Yeah, I would say that. I would lie when telling the truth would be better, just because I don't know why, but I would lie. And Pete, when I think I was about on the fourth step, he said, I want you to go back to this 10-step spot check inventory, and we're going to go through it. So he said, whenever you have dishonesty, I want you to do these four things that the spot check inventory suggests. It says, I want you to pray and ask God to remove the dishonesty in your life. I want you to talk to somebody immediately about what just happened and then what you said. You need to make amends quickly if you caused any harm. And then you need to resolutely focus your thoughts on someone you can help. Well, I got this recovery job after 30 days, and things were going sort of okay, I thought, until my dishonesty crept back up. And I was about 2 months into the job, and my boss, this was a real estate company, and I was doing leases for the company. She asked me if the so-and-so lease had been finished, that I had done, had I done it. And I said, yeah. Well, I hadn't even started it. But I wanted to look good at all costs. So I said, yeah, I've done it. She says, okay. I hung up, and then I realized I just lied to her. So I called my sponsor and told him what happened. And he said, well, okay. did you pray yet? And asked that the dishonesty be removed. And I said, yeah, just before I called you. And he says, okay, I want you to go back in there and tell you you lied. I said, I can't do that. I'll get fired. He said, well, when we started, you told me that you were willing to go to any length to recover. Were you lying then, or are you lying now? He got me. So I said, okay, I'll do that. So I went into her office, and I kind of hedged a little bit. I says, well, when I told you that this had been finished, that wasn't really quite the truth. But it will be done by tonight. I didn't come out and really say that at all, or I lied to her. Well, okay, she said, okay, do it. So I went out, and I helped one of the secretaries do some of their work, turn my attention to someone I could help. And then same thing happened. That was on a Monday. Same thing happened on Wednesday. Lied to my same issue. Have you done the so-and-so? Yes, I have. And it wasn't true. Okay, pray, call my sponsor, go back in, make amends to her, and tell her that I had not told her the truth. And I was shaken because I needed this job. You know, I was at that point, I was 48 years old, a has-been, washed-up attorney, and I needed this job. I didn't think I'd ever get another one. She kind of looked at me funny when I told her. And I said, but I will have it done tonight. Friday, I did it again. Same thing. Go back into her office and tell her, I did say, when you asked me about that, I didn't tell you the truth. It's not been done. It hasn't been done yet, but I'll finish it today. And she got this violent twitch. Because I was sure that I was done with this company. And she said, she looked at me with those dagger eyes and said, don't ever do that again. And I had never found it necessary to lie again to make myself look good or for any other reason. I had to be humiliated enough to get over this issue of honesty. That was the very first example for me that this program really worked. Because the next time it came up and she asked me, I said, no, I don't have it done yet. I haven't started. Would you like me to do that next? And I felt good. I actually told her the truth. And people came to rely on me that when I said something, it was the truth. I held that recovery job for 8 years. And it was one of the greatest blessings of my life, and it brought me to Atlanta. I got transferred down here in 2003. Well, I have been returned to sanity in this program. I can clearly differentiate the truth from the false today. I can see myself for what I really am most of the time. I'm not perfect by any means. But what I will say is that if you let this program do its magic, you will be a different person when you come out of the end of step 12 than when you started at the beginning. I had no self-esteem, no self-confidence, no nothing when I came into AA. I shook, I stammered. My very first meeting, when they asked for newcomers, and I raised my hand and says, I'm Artem Alcoholic. I couldn't get the word out. It took me two more meetings before I could say the word alcoholic and identifying myself. But it does work. That doesn't mean everything has been rosy. I've had a lot of challenges along the way. A couple of years ago, I was in a business that failed, and my personal savings were wiped out. Lost my job, and now as a 60-year-old attorney, I could not find a job. So I started my own practice, and that's worked its way to the point now that about 3 months ago, one of my clients decided to bring me on salary in his company. He's in Chicago. I'm here. He said, that's fine. We'll just do everything like we've been doing, long distance by phone and emails. And I'll give you health insurance and everything else. I've been out without health insurance for a couple of years. this program works. My faith in God is pretty strong. I think it's the most obvious and firm thing in my life, actually. I know I'm spiritually fit when I can go through life and get hit in the face with a frying pan of life. And I know you know what that's like. And my reaction is, I wonder how God's going to fix this. That to me is sobriety. The second thing I asked is, God, what do you want me to do? Just tell me what you wanted me to do and I'll be happy to do it. I'll close with this. There's a Hebrew word called shalom. And it means a number of things. It means hello and it means goodbye, sort of like aloha. It also has a much more deeper meaning. And what the real underneath meaning of shalom is that it means wholeness or completeness. If you are a whole person, if there are no parts missing from you, if you're all together, you have an inner peace that we call shalom. And that's what I would wish for each and every one of you in your journey in recovery. To do the work, I urge you to do the work, just as it's written. It works if you work it. And at the end of the day, hopefully each and every one of you will have your own part of shalom. Thank you.
Thank you, Art. Thank you for the healing.
Love has got the power.